Log Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Homemade Business 101. My name is Isaiah. I have the pleasure of introducing the host. You know him. He's everybody's hero, my best friend. Will you please join me in welcoming my granddaddy, Baba Jahi?
All right. Hey, folks, you listen to Homebase Business 101 this morning, and I want to thank my loving grandson, Isaiah, once again for that warm and beautiful introduction. Thank you so much, and it's always so great to have you introduce this show as you're learning and developing and just growing, and I'm just so proud of you. And again, thank you for your warm, wonderful introduction. Hey, people, you listen to Homebase Business 101, and I want to take here a couple of things right here. You know, from the start, I want to thank the 19,728 people that have listened to a show here on Homebase Business 101, whether it's been the Sunday morning show, as you know, you're listening this morning, the Gospel of Working from Home, or whether you've listened to the Jasari's Love show or Mentoring for Free show or our Thursday night Free Revolution show, but 19,728 people out there have decided at some point in time to stop by, pay a visit, and listen to one of our shows. And we want to thank you because this is listener-supported radio, and it would really be terrible if I looked and saw the numbers and it said zero. Zero is no hero. And so, you know, that means we must be putting something out there that has people coming back and forth to listen, and we appreciate your support. Well, today we have a great show this morning, and you know we're excited about the guest that we have on this morning, and he's been on here once before. And I need to take in one other housekeeping thing. Those of you out there that are listening to this on Facebook, go ahead and hit that share tab. Some of you have been doing that, and that's been helping a lot. Hit that share tab and send that share link out. So that your Facebook friends know that you're listening to this show this morning, and they can chime in also. And go ahead and hit that tweet button, too, so you can tweet this out to people out there that are listening, or we can get them chimed in and listen to today's show. Today's show, we're going to have the author, Mr. George Sabir, on with us this morning, and he's going to be talking about a book he wrote back in 1994 called Money Issues in Black Male-Female Relationships. He will discuss this topic with us today. You know, and we want to get into this topic today. The topic of black female relationships is an emotionally charged one, and each sex usually feels compelled to define and defend their position and perspectives on their gender. Sometimes it doesn't take much for a loud shouting match to develop, and what was supposed to be a discussion degenerates into another argument, discouraging further attempts at a dialogue between the sexes. Neither black men or women can afford to remain ignorant of the money and financial management continue to pass the ignorance down to their offspring. Slavery was an economic system to benefit whites and exploit blacks. Blacks people's continued financial ignorance continues a similar imbalance in the economy today. We have substantial resources and substantial resources, and we have no one to blame for the degree of our poverty but ourselves. And we're not looking at this from the guy steals position or other people, we are worse enemies and all of that. But, I mean, we have resources. Not only must black men and women better understand each other, but each needs to learn how to see the contradictions in their behaviors and statements. While we must not dwell on our mistakes, we certainly must be willing to face up to them and correct them if our relationships are to have opportunities to grow. So, that's the backdrop of, show description for today and what we want to get into. Let me tell you a little bit about Mr. Sabir before I bring him up. George Sabir considered himself primarily as an educator and became a black studies instructor at Seton Hall University at the age of 25. He spent 5 years in the Black Culture Nationalist Movement in Los Angeles with Dr. Marlana Karinger. George Sabir was educated at California State University of Los Angeles and Rutgers University Graduate School. His first publication in 1980, Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America, was the first practical guide on money management and economic improvement written specifically for black people. In 1985, he offered his second book, Black Folks' Guide to Business Success. Another groundbreaking book appeared in 1988 with the publication of Getting Black Folks to Sell, the first and only book to discuss selling from a black perspective. He has appeared on television with Donahue, The Today Show, Tony Brown's Journal, BET, Sonya Friedman's Show, The 700 Club, and he's been on radio from coast to coast. Dozens of newspapers and magazines have featured articles on Mr. Sabir's books. His book, Money Issues in Black Female Relationships, when it went to press, he had over 100,000 of his other books that previous books have been sold. He's a frequent speaker on college campuses and at black businesses and professional conferences. Business concepts are explained within the context of black history and culture. The author also, Mr. Sabir, was an original participant in the first four Kwanzaa celebrations, and he has an unpublished manuscript called Kwanzaa and the Black Economy that I hope he gets out at some point in time out there in the marketplace. So with no further ado, I'd like to bring up Mr. Sabir. Good morning, Mr. Sabir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Brother Jahi. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine. And, we want to, be able to share some things from your book that you wrote in 1994. And in 1994, give us the backdrop of why you wrote the book before we get into some of the things that you share in the book. You know, what was going on during that time that, you know, you would previously have written business books and then you dove into...
Well, basically, when I first started even thinking about writing books, the black bookstore was a male-dominated place. Most of the books in the black bookstores were on history, were on religion like Islam and so forth, biography, you know, the story of Du Bois, the story of Paul Robeson, the story of Malcolm X. And it was not a place that black women would frequent that often. If they did, they would come in, get books on religion, get books for black youngsters, just starting school, getting understanding life from a black child's perspective. And then that started to change dramatically with the rise in poetry. You had poetry by Sonia Sanchez, poetry by Alice Walker, then into Zaki. Shaki's book came out when Colored Girls Considered Suicide. And then... I forgot the sister's name just that fast. Give me the name of the book we were talking about.
Oh,
Waiting to Exhale.
Yeah,
you had Toni Morrison, and then you had Waiting to Exhale. When Waiting to Exhale came out, it completely changed the map of black book business, black bookstores. You had a huge number of black women that then came into black bookstores to buy their book at one time. I remember a distributor telling me the book was selling 50,000 copies a week, and that was absolutely unheard of. Most black books did not sell 50,000 copies, you know, in 2 or 3 years. So for a book to sell 50,000 copies a week, I mean, that was just off the chart. And what happened was that major white publishers began to say, maybe there's something to this whole fiction, female books for black women, fiction area, and we're going to go out here and look for the next book similar to this one. So that's what you had. You had a lot of books by women trying to duplicate the success of that book. And as much as they denied it, it was a lot of black male bashing going on. A lot of black male bashing. It was like a dam had burst and the emotions of women just was unleashed, talking about their frustration in dealing with black men. And, of course, that made it a little bit more difficult for nonfiction books to be sold because so much attention, so much publicity, so many interviews. I mean, it was hard to get a radio interview. It was hard to get on television to talk about, you know, a real, not saying that black male-female relationships wasn't a real problem, but it was difficult for a nonfiction, particularly male author, unless you were already well-known like a Hakeem Mahboudi or somebody like that. It was difficult to get coverage because the basketball court had been completely tilted to the other team's side. So there was a lot of hunger to get black women on the air. And black women became hosts of so many shows. What new black programs came on television, they had basically black female hosts. Again, looking at the Oprah success and seeing how you know, she was on the scene, and so it was a turn to the black female perspective, which in and of itself is not a bad thing. Matter of fact, it's a good thing that a side whose story had not been heard before was able to now come forward. The difficult or the frustrating thing is that all they seem to want to talk about, with all the problems going on in the world, the only thing they really seemed to talk about was their frustration with black men. And that's where I had a problem. There's a lot of other things going on in the world except your relationship with your boyfriend. So I put this book together basically for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you listen to the black woman's story, she did have some legitimate questions about things that she wasn't getting an answer to. So that needed to be, you know, addressed. The other thing was that there needed to be a black male answer to some of the things that she was saying. There needed to be a black male perspective on relationships, because the major white publishers was not interested in publishing the black male perspective on relationships. They didn't see that as a viable market. Black men were not going to stand in line to buy a book on relationships. That was just not what they read about. And so this book was designed to, like, bridge a gap that I saw, and to kind of put me sort of in the discussion, and also to bring up a topic that nobody was really addressing, and that was how money plays a role in relationships. We had been told a lot of times that the number one reason that people were breaking up and getting divorced was over money, and that may or may not have been true. The fact that it was stated so many times, you know, sort of made it true, made it seem like it was true. And nobody was talking that much about money in the relationships. So I put this book out thinking I had a winner, and thinking that I could make a contribution, thinking that there would be some intelligent discussion that would take place around the concrete issues that were plaguing the community. And it just didn't happen that way. But that's why the book was put out in 90, well, it was written in like in 93, 94, and I think came out in 94.
Okay, so that gives us the backdrop. And this is just paragraph in here that I want to share with our listening audience before I get into some questions about some of the content of the book, that, you know, that is the premise for why I, you know, went through to revisit the book, because I'm really concerned about young people and their upbringing and their focus. And, you know, this show is called Home-Based Business 101, and I do a lot of focus on business, and I work with youth teaching entrepreneurship and other things. You have this statement I want to go through and then let you, you know, share with us around that, and then we'll get into some questions about some of the content of the book. He said, as children, most black people learn that all money comes from and goes back to white people. Children learn that honest money comes from working, and working almost always is depicted as a form of physical labor. The average child gets little, if any, orientation towards supporting black businesses or starting their own business. Kids are pushed to do well in school, often at the expense of their own creative and productive capacities. The spoken or unspoken assumption directed to black children is that with a better education, they can get a better job with white people. With this better job, one can then make more money from white people, which can then be paid right back to them, white people, to purchase the products that white people produce. Living the good life is usually defined as having more of these products and things than the rest of your peers. And, I mean, it's a lot said in that statement. I mean, I see when working with youth, how the whole thing pushed in school, they do lose their creative and productive capacities. Hardly anyone's talking to young people about business except for the drug dealers. You know, the material acquisition of, you know, the more of these things that you got that glitters is gold. I mean, and then in the relationship piece, you know, there's a thing called the material girl. And, you know, and some people end up in these relationships where the material girl drives them, you know, crazy. But, you know, that's a powerful paragraph you have there. You'd like to enlighten us a little bit or around, you know, what you saw in terms of, you know, that in relationship to children and why you made that statement?
Well, a lot went through my mind as you was reading that. First of all, the mind-blowing thing is the fact that that was written in 93, 94. And what we see today is so much way, way past what we saw in 94. I mean, we have all this these facts and figures to say how much the black community is suffering. But when we look to see in the ghetto how much money is spent on iPods and iPads and this cell phone for $300 and this gadget and this thing and high-def TV and 50,000-inch screens and all that, I mean, the emphasis on these hundreds and hundreds of dollars of gadgets is so profound now in 2010 that it made what I was looking at in 1994 look like a set of marbles. And that's discouraging. It just shows you that it's just going on and on. It's like, you know, if I thought that was bad then, what do you say about stuff now? So that's the first thing that crossed my mind. The second thing that crossed my mind is the fact that I always thought that when black people control the educational system, that is to say, we have a lot of black school superintendents, we have a lot of black principals, we have a substantial number of black people in the state departments of education across the United States. I always thought naively back in the 60s that when we get black people in those positions that they would look at the educational system and say, okay, what is it that we have here that really isn't that necessary, that's outdated for the 21st century? And let's replace it with things that are absolutely required or should be required and absolutely necessary to be included in the current educational system. And how can anybody expect that a person can travel from grades 1 through 12 and take American history or world history 4 and 5 times, but yet there's nothing in the curriculum about financial literacy, nothing that teaches them, you know, how to fill out a check, how to balance a checkbook, how to set up a budget, what is interest rates, what is a mortgage, how do you go about buying the most important thing you will ever probably buy in your life, which is a house. How do you go about doing that and doing it intelligently? And how much should you spend on a car? What is a high interest rate versus a low interest rate? And the fact of the matter is that the teachers do not exist that are qualified to even teach these courses because they didn't have it as part of their education. So all they do is that they emphasize the same things now, pretty much, that was emphasized when I was in school 30, 40, 50 years ago. Things that have no real meaning in the quality of life for the average black school graduate. You know, there's lots of subjects that you expected to take, which looked at on a practical level, you're never going to use. You're going to use it only to pass this test. Now, 1 or 2%, a half a percent, might take calculus and take it to another level and become an accountant or some high-tech engineering type. That's okay. But let's not take the whole class there because they're not going to use some of this stuff. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's a shame that students are still victims of a poorly constructed education system which guarantees that they're going to leave out at 18 years old, ready to go to war and get killed, or ready to become a father, but knowing absolutely nothing about the financial system that they're going to have to navigate for the rest of their lives. And I think that's the real tragedy here.
Right. Okay. Great. Now, as we dive into the book that sort of helps us, you know, as you said, what you just shared, you know, where all of this mess, you know, come from. Too often people say, well, you know, why do we always have to bring up slavery? You know, what impact does slavery have on shaping black women and black men's views and values in their relationships?
Okay, now this is where traditionally I would start to feel the heat from the women because they don't like what it is that I say when I address that question. Logically, if you just look at it logically, you don't even have to know history. Logically, if somebody says to you, a house slave and a field slave, you would get in your mind the kind of work requirements you would probably have to perform if you were a house slave, and you would look at the work requirements that you would logically probably have to perform if you were a field slave. Most of us, if not all of us, have heard of the difference between a so-called house nigger and a field slave. You know, the house slave lived close to the master. They were physically cleaner. I mean, you didn't walk around the house as dirty as a house slave as what the field slave looked and smelled like out there picking cotton all day. Usually they were the lighter-skinned slaves. Usually they were, they could have very well been the offspring of the master and some child and some slave that he had sex with out there in the slave quarters. So it could have been their biological child that became house slave. The house slave learned to appreciate the values and the lifestyle of the slave master. What were their duties? Well, their duties was to clean clothes, to keep the house clean, to cook the food, to take care of the children, to make a life in the house that would free the white woman from a lot of the physical drudgery of running a house and yet make it satisfactory to the male master as well. And, of course, these white people were descendants of Europeans, and even though they were farmers, a lot of them wanted to keep their appreciation for European culture. So there was a certain amount of Europeanization culturally of the house, particularly among, you know, wealthy plantation owners. So when you add that up, you have a situation where most of the house slaves were women, and that's important to understand. When you talk about the difference in values between the house slave and the field slave, we're really talking about the difference in values between black men and black women. Now, I'm not saying black women did not work in the fields, and I'm not saying that black men did not work in the house, but predominantly The house slaves were women, and predominantly the field slaves were men. So they developed two different perspectives of the value of white American culture and how it related to them personally. The field slave had a tendency to maintain what residual African cultural aspects that he or she could remember, whether it be songs, whether it be dances, whether it be myths, aspects of religion, maybe aspects of African language that were still repeated in the fields among where people could talk among themselves out of the earshot of, you know, the overseers and whatnot. So you had this this formation of appreciation of European ways of looking at things going on in the house among the women, and what little preservation of African attributes that were being maintained by the men in the field. And, of course, that's how these two sets of people started going down different paths. When I was growing up in Philadelphia, most of the brothers that I knew did not care about the latest Paris fashions or the latest Italian shoes or the latest whatever. That was a woman thing. So even into the mid-20th century, 300-400 years after we got here, you know, the women are still into looking at European things. I've never met too many brothers growing up that say, I would love to take a trip to Paris, France, or Rome, Italy. You hear a woman say that in a second. You don't hear many brothers say that. Brothers will say, well, I want to go, you know, to Africa. I want to go to Egypt. I want to see the pyramids. You know, a lot of your black women would say, well, why would I want to go to Africa? You know, so even to this very day, there's this appreciation for European things on the part of the women. You know, women look at white women's hairstyles to see maybe how they could style their hair. No black man looks at white men's hairstyle to get an idea of how they should shape their hair. For the most part, I mean, there's exceptions to anything. So, you know, just trying to be objective, trying to be real, these are the patterns that I've seen, and it filters down into the perspectives and the arguments that black men and black women get into based on them going down two divergent roads culturally.
Okay. And you make another statement. You have a chapter you talk about. You know, you say, my question is, what do you mean when you say that black man has manhood problems that just won't go away? I mean, because, you know, one of the issues in this whole relationship peace thing is you know, between the men and the women is, what is black manhood? And you,
and
you talk about, you know, you have a chapter around that and dealing with what you call black manhood problems that just won't go away.
Okay, well, for those people that think that this book is just about female bashing, you know, I try to also call the shot a shot the way I see it when it comes to black men as well. So this might be considered black male bashing. There's three different definitions, as I see it, of what constitutes manhood as it relates to our experience and situation here in America. Number one, most of us that have any kind of understanding of African history and culture knows that there is such a thing as the rites of passage. That time in a young man's life where he's counseled by the elders and told to go through a certain series of tests, so to speak, after which, if he passes, he's now considered a man. And we saw that in Roots, the movie. We hear about it a lot. And, you know, traditionally it may have something to do with hunting. It may have something to do with circumcision. It may have something to do with any number of things. But African villages, African societies had rites of passage, and they weren't universal. They weren't the same all the way through the continent. But each group had a set of challenges, and the challenges said, if you do A, B, C, D, and E, we here in the village, in our town, in our community, will now recognize you as a 14 or 15 or 13 or 17-year-old man as opposed to a boy, and we will give you the respect and deference of that, but you got to pass the test. When we came here to America, we couldn't practice those African rites of passages because we were in bondage, we were slaves, we were told what to do from the time we got up in the morning to the time we went to bed at night for the most part. And I don't think there was much allowed in the way of congregating unless maybe it was in a church or something. So we were not allowed to become men in the African sense of the word. So what other options were there? Well, there's two more. The other option was the white definition of manhood. The white definition of manhood said that, first of all, you got a certain kind of training or education in a particular field that allowed you to support yourself and eventually a family, whether that be formal education in a school, or whether that be learning a trade, whether it be being a farmer, being a blacksmith, being a carpenter, being a tailor, whatever the case may be, you now have a trade. Then owning property was another passage of manhood. If you owned a plot of land that you could build a house on and raise crops and do whatever, that was part of the whole manhood thing. Then you could vote. America was founded on representative government, so the whole voting thing was real important to distinguish America from the other countries in the world. So that was a very sacred thing to vote. And so if you could vote, if you could serve in the military and protect the community as a militiaman or military, you know, all those things constituted, you know, a kind of rites of passage for white men. And, of course, white men would never consider letting black men go through this. We couldn't own property unless, you know, we were so-called freed. That came later. We certainly couldn't vote. There was no provision made for us to guarantee that we learn certain skills. We couldn't even protect our wives and children. They could have been sold away from us at the decision of the master. So we couldn't be a man, be seen as a man, fulfill the role of an American man based on the white people's standard of manhood, because that would have made us free and independent as opposed to slaves. So if we couldn't follow the African standard of manhood and we couldn't follow the white man's standard of manhood, then there's a third standard of manhood, and that is universal. I think it's universal. What's the universal standard of manhood? The universal standard of manhood is that when your wife and family are threatened, you fight back against whoever is threatening them. And if it costs you your life, then you give your life to try to save the welfare of your wife and your kids. That's the way it is, I think, in every single society in the history of the planet Earth, that there's no society where men just stop idly by and let another man come and take his woman, take his kids without putting up a fight. That's what I call the universal standard of manhood. And I think most black men were not in a position to do that. If the master came by his shack and said, I want your wife tonight. But the master came by and said, next month I'm going to sell your son and your daughter. Oh, I want your daughter. She's now old enough for me to screw, so I want to screw her. most black men, I think, just had to sit idly by and watch and accept that as happening without really doing anything. Now, how many black men do we know stalked the master and killed him and as a means of protecting his family? We'll never know because black people didn't keep score on that front, and white people certainly weren't going to advertise the fact that, you know, slaves rebelled and killed me for messing with his daughter. So we'll never know what percentage of the time. We'll never know approximate numbers of how many times that happened. But we know that in most cases, white men got away with it, and black men just had to accept the fact that he was out of control. So with him not being able to meet the universal standard of manhood, with him not being able to meet the African standard of manhood, without him being able to meet the white male standard of manhood, we have a manhood problem. And after slavery, it became during slavery and after slavery, and to this very day, you know, we have men with all kinds of different definitions of what's manhood. Is manhood having the most number of women and the most children by those women? You know, some men believe that. Is manhood having the most money and being able to buy the most stuff? I'm the man, so to speak. Some people believe that. Is manhood being able to physically dominate other men? You know, don't mess with me, I'll knock you out. Don't mess with me, I can have you shot. Don't mess with me, I can take you to the next world. Is manhood showing your physical domination over other men who are usually black and they don't bother with white men too much? That's some people's definition of manhood. I see in the last 15 years, and this is real strange to me, that when I was growing up, I didn't even know what a what's that dog that people always use to fight?
Pit bull.
Pit bull. I never saw a pit bull dog from the time I was 3 years old, maybe till I was in my 20s. I mean, I had no concept of pit bulls. But I've seen symbolically that a lot of these teenage thugs have pit bulls, and the ferociousness of their pit bull dogs and their ability to kill another man's dog somehow as in a psychological extension of black manhood and domination and power. So expressed that way, you know, I'm bad because my dog is bad. You know, the whole Michael Vick football mentality. I mean, it's just sick. So to this day, black men, you know, have a twisted definition. In the prisons, my understanding is that men who are not homosexuals, at least they didn't start off that way, will become intimate with another inmate who he'll call his woman, they use another word, and will have homosexual acts with this man as a way of dominating him sexually, and that's supposed to be a definition of manhood. So, I mean, it's just sick, absolutely sick, the many, many means that black men will go through to kind of express a very frustrating feeling of not feeling like a man by using all these other symbolic means, as I see it. Now, that's just my opinion. I've never had a chance to throw this out there to that many people. I've never had that many people respond to me what they think about what it is that I'm saying, but that's what I get. And so when I say manhood problems that won't go away, mm-hmm. I mean, to this day, especially in the prisons, we see this domination, you know, you're going to be my bitch because that's what I need to have here in this cell. and since I'm the man, I'm going to dominate you. I mean, that's crazy. That's sick. And it all stems from the fact, to me, it all stems from the fact that we never sufficiently confronted the real enemy, which was the white man. If we had confronted the white man, yes, there would be less black people in the United States than there is now, because he probably would have stopped slavery, because he would have seen that it was too much risk in bringing over these Africans to America, because at the slightest opportunity, they would do whatever was necessary to sacrifice their life and kill the master. And once the master was real clear about that, I don't think he would have been importing, you know, his potential assassin as often as he actually did. But because we never developed a reputation of that, then I guess he felt slavery was a safe institution to continue. And unfortunately, you know, we are still doing it today. And I want to say one other thing, which really, I'll remember this for the rest of my life, that I think ties to the same thing. I remember reading an article in the paper during the time that black people were lined up to vote for Nelson Mandela. And I don't know if you saw the movie Invictus or not, but white people knew without a shadow of a doubt how bad they treated black people in South Africa. They knew that. And they assumed that it was going to be the natural law, the natural order of things, that when black people were going to get back in power, that they were going to get vengeance against the white South Africans for all that they had done in those years, the murders, the kidnappings, the torture, and so forth. And I remember reading this quote by this one white lady who saw that Nelson Mandela was elected and that there were no riots, no fires, no explosions, no anything in the streets. And she said, well, if we would have known that they were going to be this peaceful, we probably would have let Nelson Mandela out of jail a long time ago. And that, I will remember that for the rest of my life, because just like America, what happened was shortly after Nelson Mandela got elected, I don't know if you followed the news, but there was a huge, huge increase in black-on-black crime in South Africa. There was a huge increase in rapes. Black men raping black women, a huge rise in the rate of AIDS in South Africa, because a lot of the men had AIDS and then they would give it to women that they were raping anyway, and then the women would then give that AIDS to other men. So, I mean, and again, I see the same concept of when you don't confront your enemy directly and take out your vengeance against the person who actually wronged you, what you do is that you turn it on yourself, because you don't think that you're going to be prosecuted. You're not privy to the same kind of punishment. You're not likely to be as pursued if you kill another brother as you would if you killed a white man. So I saw a lot of similarities between, you know, the liberation, so-called, well, it was a kind of a liberation in black South Africa and white South Africa relationships, as I saw in the United States. So I just want to get that out there, too.
Okay. We got some people in the chat room, you know, making some comments around some of the things you're saying. One person said, hey, this brother is on point with his assessments, you know, when our person says, hey, the Willie Lynch making of a slave is just more mundane in today's time. And, you know, people say, hey, they've seen some of the same things that you're talking about. Another person says, hey, black men and women have been taught to harm only themselves and to love everyone else. Another person made a comment. They use black women to help keep the black man in check by giving her more opportunity than the black man. There are more black women who has a job and a place to stay than black men. You know, giving her welfare and low-paying jobs. And, you know, it's the master art of mental war. These are some of the comments that people are sharing in the chat room as you are, you know, sharing this information. So, you know, I haven't seen anyone here in the chat room that has offered any disagreement. They've sort of saying, hey, you on point, and they appreciate, you know, what you are putting out there. He said there are many black men that are very educated but not given jobs. So, you know, again, how the systematic things that are going on. One of the other things you talked about, the Mandela piece, was here in Carolina, I don't know about in other parts of the country, when Obama was elected, and I mean those of us who really understand the system knew that, you know, that the President of the United States is, you know, he's basically in charge of a corporation called America, and that those of us that were conscious understood that it wasn't but so much Obama was going to be able to do. But anyway, when Obama was elected, here in area of North Carolina that I live at, the white people went and they bought all of the guns. All the guns and ammo was gone. You couldn't find any. They, again, as you said, they thought that when Obama got elected that black people was going to turn on them, like, you know, like the people say, white on rice, you know, whatever. And this fear, I mean, and then as we see the Tea Party emerge and these other things, and you know, the people, we want our government back. We want our country back. You know, it's really interesting how, as I said, people, one of the good things about Obama being elected is that a lot of the white racists that were in the closet have come out of the closet.
Right. Right. I see, there's a whole lot that white people do not know about black people. And it would blow their mind if they knew it. Now, black leaders are not going to tell them any of these things because it's not in their interest. It's like airing dirty laundry. First of all, white people assume that there's a lot more unity among black people than what it actually is. They know that Asians are unified. They know that Indians are unified. They know that Arabs are unified. They know that even though there's different Hispanic groups, you know, Cubans versus Mexicans versus Puerto Ricans, they understand that the groups are solidified. They have no idea how disorganized and ununified black people are. They just assume a unity that's not there. They also assume that we look out for the most important aspects of our interests the same way that they do. Like if they had bad schools that were miseducating their kids, they would stand up and take a serious stand against what was going on. They assume that black people would. They don't know that black people can know that their schools are doing bad and just accept it because, well, we're powerless. We've always been powerless, so we'll just do the best that we can and let them finish, you know. So what white people do is that they project their looking out for self values onto us without knowing that we don't look out for ourselves. So they buy guns because they know the stuff that they did against us. They know enough of it to know that if they were in our position, that they would have some serious hostility toward us, and they might look to try to make amends. But they don't know how forgiving we are of white people. It's only other black people that we're not forgiving of. You know, this brother stepped on my shoe, so I'm going to kill him. This brother looked at me funny. This brother brushed up against my woman when he was trying to get to the men's room, so I'm going to beat him up because he touched her breasts or touched her butt. I mean, we're unforgiving when it comes to ourselves, but we're very forgiving when it comes to them. We may talk like we're unforgiving, but as far as actually doing anything, we're going to do nothing. And I think the thing that really, really symbolizes, and I talked about this in the book, I believe, is the whole rap music industry. I mean, that is a joke, an absolute joke. And I think somebody like, what's the brother that plays on Law and Order?
Law and Order.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of his name.
Well, you know who I'm talking about.
What are you talking about, right? If anybody's in the chat room know who we're talking about, just go ahead and
Now, here's a guy. Here's a guy that comes out with a song called F the Police, right?
Oh.
And the police get on him, you know, why should the media of America, Ice-T, that's his
name. Ice-T, right, yeah.
Yeah, why should the media of America allow this guy to put out a record saying F the Police and legitimize that idea? I mean, we work hard in the community. We're subject to get shot by perpetrators. And then he takes that and actually plays a cop in the real world. Not that TV is the real world, but
getting
paid every year for the last 10 years mm-hmm. is real. You know what I mean?
Right.
Then he ends up playing a cop on TV, which he was one of the only ones, the first ones out the box, saying F the Police. So, I mean, what white owners of record companies did is said, okay, you have a group of frustrated black men here, and rather than let them go out here and really kill somebody and really do some damage to our white culture, we're going to develop an industry that's specially for them. And in this industry, they're going to play at being mad at us. They're going to cuss. They're going to fight. They're going to shoot. They're going to show guns. We're going to allow them to express their most greatest outrage against white people. And then we're going to turn around and sell it for them. And then we're going to take the money from their outrage and continue running America, continuing running the world, laugh all the way to the bank. Now, we'll allow them to make some money, you know, a certain number of pennies per record or nickels per record. So they'll get paid and they'll live well and they'll go out and stupidly buy these gold chains and big cars and all the other stupid fur coats and shit that they normally buy with their money. They don't know what to do with money. So we'll allow them and they'll be happy and we'll be happy, and it's a game. And it's a game. But at the meantime, you know, the whole black culture got caught up in that thing, and it's a complete waste of time, waste of money. We have nothing much to show for it. And I just looked at it and said, this is some sad, sick stuff. And when given the opportunity, the same so-called against the system rap artists will become very much a part of the system.
Right.
And whether it's T.I., whether it's Ludacris, whether it's, I mean, I know some of the bigger names. I don't know, you know, the real big name. And some of them do some things for the community, but I mean, it's a game, and it all has to do with this confusion over definition of what constitutes a man. In their videos, they play to in being the man that they really wanted to be, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they want to be somebody that can say F the Police,
you
know, but they can't.
The thing that's really deep, I remember when Minister Farrakhan did a piece where he asked the rappers to come clean. He said, I need y'all to let the youth know that those videos, y'all don't live like that. You know, and that you're sending a message out to young people, you know, through an industry that is, you know, marketed and controlled by somebody else, but you don't live like that. And, I, you know, one of the things that I do when I work with young people, like when I was in New Orleans, you know, Master P doesn't live in New Orleans. He don't live in the hood. He lives in Mandeville. He's got a mansion across the lake.
Right.
You know, I mean, the lifestyle that is portrayed in terms of people relating to Master P, he don't live that lifestyle. Right. Now, his brother tried to see murder. I mean, that was his name, and he actually did murder somebody. That's why he's in the joint now. But, you know, when you take on a name like C. Murder, then, you know, I guess you try to act it out. But as we're talking about music and that leads to another question, you know, so we both, you know, talked about the impact that music had on us growing up. And it was a different era, you know, and it was, you know, the era we're growing up with, you know, Smokey Robinson, the Temptations, and Murray Wells, you know, My Guy, and you know, Isaac Hayes with his rap. I mean, share, you know, as we talk about our own personal development, you know, so that people don't think we're talking about this issue in isolation, like pointing at other people, but through how, you know, personally growing up and developing and how music impact, you know, your life in terms of your view on relationships when you was a teenager and you know, we wanted, let's dive into that for a few here.
Well, one of the things I said in the beginning of writing this book, the book itself now is, what, 16 years old.
Right.
So that dates it right there. But even when I wrote the book, I was almost 50, and I made it a statement in the book saying that I really couldn't tell people that I could identify with all the values and the thoughts and the sentiments of younger people, people in their 20s, because I wasn't at that age. I didn't really know what was going on with that particular age group. Now we're two generations removed, and I certainly don't know what's going on in the heads of the 19 and 20-year-olds that are showing their butts and walking with the pants halfway down and all that other kind of stuff that I can't relate to. But I know that music was something that men and women tried to poetically express how much they cared for each other. I mean, if you wanted to just make it into a one-sentence summary, that's what it was about. Now, it doesn't mean that they didn't show frustration, you know, or like Mr. Big Stuff, Who Do You Think You Are? I mean, yeah, they put records like that out there. But for the most part, it seemed like, you know, there were people like Mary Wells, Nothing You Can Do, Can Say or Do Can Take Me Away From My Guy. I mean, they acknowledged the fact that there was misunderstandings, that there were problems, but we're going to work it out, and I love you, and I hope you love me. And that was basically, you know, a whole industry. I mean, Motown industry was built on basically that one single concept, millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in records and live performances was built on just that one concept. I love you. This is how much I want you to know it. You love me, and I understand that, and blah, blah, blah. Even the names given to the groups, you had the Miracles, you had the Impressions, you had the Temptations. I mean, the names that they chose to call themselves suggested that, you know, they were in a positive frame of mind, as opposed to somebody calling themselves C. Murder, you know. I mean, it's just the exact opposite. It's even more than the exact opposite. If you can imagine that. So it would be, I would love to go to a seminar where everybody on the panel was between, you know, 17 and 30 years old, and they would explain to me how the culture that they are a part of today, you know, why they like it, how they came to appreciate it, what there is about it to appreciate, because I just don't get it, you know. I recognize the fact that it's selling all over the world. You can go to some countries that have nothing to do with Harlem, but yet, you know, they're into rap music and hip-hop culture. I recognize the fact that they've created a worldwide phenomenon, but why they enjoy calling themselves nigger, why it's okay to be a hoe in 57 different countries, I just don't understand that. I don't.
Right, right, right. Okay, we are we're winding down. I wanted an extended show a little bit so we can get through maybe one more question and then talk about, you know, what you're currently doing and you know, and share some other things with people, because we want to also bring people up to speed in terms of how to deal with money issues and other stuff. And so before doing that part of the wrap up, I want to revisit Waiting to Exhale, and you talk about she has another book coming out about the characters, and we could take about, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to just sort of talk about the four characters in Waiting to Exhale, and because you said the backdrop for writing this book, it was during that time, you know, that this book made tremendous impact. I mean, you know, you shared something that early in the part of the show. I mean, I didn't know it was selling 50,000 copies a week at the time. I knew it was selling. I mean, and you said that is definitely, you know, so it was definitely a phenomena that, you know, that hit and took place. And a lot of times, you know, people relate to things like it is the gospel truth. So, you know, it was four characters in the book. And let's talk about those characters a little bit here.
Okay, first of all, let me say a couple of things. Number one, I saw very clearly that there was a big difference between what was in the book and what was in the movie. What was in the movie was not a portrayal of what was in the book. And I remember getting upset at that. When I first, you know, left the movie, I was upset because it was just different. The book said one thing, the movie said something else. And then it dawned on me that I had been so wrapped up in nonfiction and truth and research and accuracy that I was dealing with the world of fiction. Then when you're dealing with the world of fiction, then you could just say anything. Just open up your mouth or put down your pen and just say anything. It doesn't matter because it's all about entertainment. And nothing has to be logical. Nothing has to be true. Nothing has to be accurate. You don't even have to be consistent. Just put down there whatever you feel that day. And if you feel something totally different tomorrow, let your emotions take over and put that down, even if it contradicts what you said the day before, because there's nothing about accuracy. And so when I realized that, then I just kind of divorced myself from the whole thing, because black people have real problems. And unless we decide we're going to deal with stuff the way they actually are, instead of treating it like entertainment and it don't have to be consistent, then we're always just going to be like a cat chasing his tail, going around and around and going nowhere and getting real tired going nowhere. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to say is that I really did not look at the book or even the chapter on those characters for 15, 16, 17 years. I mean, I kind of dismissed them. So I don't even remember the four characters. I know there were four women, but the woman that I think I spent the most time talking about and focused on was the woman Bernadine, who I think was played by, what's the sister that played Tina Turner in the movie?
Angela Bassett.
Angela something?
Angela Bassett plays Tina Turner in the movie.
Yeah, right, right. So, that was the character I focused on because it was weird contradictions. First of all, in the book, it sounded like that she was not concerned about money. Her husband had offered her a generous divorce settlement, and he did not intend to leave her, you know, bare and struggling. But yet, you know, at that time, she said, this is not about money, okay? And then, in the end, she ended up setting a car that he gave her. It wasn't his car. The car that he gave her on fire, closed. And then when it was time to actually go through the divorce, then she tried to get as much money as possible. So I had said in the book, jokingly, but at the same time, kind of seriously, that there is a recessive gene in women that basically lies fallow. It does that not even come out until a woman gets married and decides to file for divorce. And this gene is a get-all-you-can-get kind of gene, and it doesn't even make itself known even to the person that it's in until it's time to go your separate ways. And then all the lies that the woman told throughout the years about it's not about money, this gene then becomes activated, and when it comes time to go to court, then all of a sudden she wants as much money as she can get. So I had a problem with that particular character. But the thing is that the movie and the book tried to make these women sound like they were the best that the black community could offer in terms of the development of black women. I mean, they were professional. They had good incomes. They owned their own, you know, spots. I mean, they lived in good, solid, upper middle class surroundings. But yet their actions and their thoughts were just like the typical ghetto sister sapphires from the hood, and their vengefulness, getting back at the men that wronged them, you know, played out the same as somebody from, you know, the hood in the project. So I just thought that that was just a heavy contradiction as well. I mean, if anything's supposed to be elevated, it's supposed to be your brain and your reactions and your behavior, not just the clothes you have on your back. So that's part of my take on Waiting to Exhale.
Okay. As we wrap up here so that we can close out with some positive stuff here so people don't think, you know, we're focusing on problems. As we wrestle with solutions in dealing with, you know, black male-female relationships, how do we make marriage work socially and economically? Because, again, this show is Home-Based Business 101. You know, we put out there earlier about, you know, raising our children and not teaching them about business and not teaching them about finance and those things. So what do you, if you had to offer a prescription to, black couples, black people as they're coming together, what would you say based on your own personal experiences and from what your panoramic view, what are some key components that need to happen in a relationship for a marriage to work socially and economically?
Well, I think the number one thing, and I think I alluded to it in the very beginning, is that we as a people absolutely must go through an educational process in financial literacy. We must understand how money, it doesn't even really have to be about business, although certain conclusions would probably show that business has to be dealt with. But they must understand, you know, about money, about what things cost, what the whole delayed gratification concept is about, you know, what financing is about, interest rates. A lot of people take 15, 20 years to pay for their college loans that they use to go to school. And the more prestigious the school, the greater the loan, the longer it takes to pay it off. So that Obama, the President of the United States, just got finished paying his Harvard Law School loans just a few years before he became president, and the only reason he was able to do that was because he had a best-selling book that got him millions of dollars so he can then turn around and pay off Harvard University. So, you know, the average person is not going to not only get to Harvard, but they're certainly not going to have a best-selling book where they're not going to get those big royalty checks. So we have to deal with financial literacy. Otherwise, we enter a relationship where thousands of economically based decisions have to be made, and it's the blind leading the blind. I don't know any more than you. You don't know any more than me. I just know what I like. You just know what you like. So we're going to make decisions based on what we like as opposed to the reality of what the financial system is based on. And it's a trap. You know, our community is filled with rent-a-centers where we pay three times as much for an item as what the item is actually worth. And people count on our bad credit. I mean, you walk in the store, you say, I know I got bad credit, so therefore I'm going to have to pay a little more. And then the woman is so friendly and nice to you, and you're not even aware that you're going to pay two or three times what something really costs because you're willing to accept it because you know your credit's bad. I mean, so that's a major, major part of, I think, having a harmonious relationship is to come to some kind of terms of agreement as far as the financial tip. The other thing that's important is we, black women in particular, have to respect, you know, the man's drive to be his own boss. Men also have to stop being jealous of women who can be their own boss. I know a lot of women, I don't know a lot now, but I did know quite a number of women who could have been very successful in business and made a significant amount of money, but their husband wouldn't let them because he didn't want to witness how good she can do on her own. Maybe she could do so good that she wouldn't need him. Well, if that was the case, then that relationship wasn't on sound footing to begin with. I mean, I know there are extenuating circumstances and there's all kinds of stuff that are unforeseen, but you have a situation where women are telling men to get a real job and they don't want the men to go into business. And then you have men telling women, I want you home and I don't want you being out there interacting with all these customers and people because I need you here, when actually it's just an excuse not to see her succeed and make more money than him. So, I mean, there's a lot of that going out, too. That's always been a case as far as I could see. I could go on, but, you know, I think I've maybe been rambling too much at this point.
Okay. Hey, we appreciate, you know, the points that you shared this morning. And what I'd like to be able to do now is make sure people have your contact information. You do still have one book that people can actually purchase directly from you, and that's Getting Black Folks to Sell. And since this is a business show, we can wrap up with you, you know, sharing a little bit about that book and how people can contact you to get a copy of that book, and why you feel it's still a very important book for people to use that are in the direct sales industry, since I have a lot of people that follow the show that are in direct sales and multi-level marketing.
Right.
With your contact information and
Okay. The best way to get me, really the best way, is by telephone. I do return calls. There's one lady who ordered the book last time I was on the show. I reached out to her twice so far and left messages. She's not gotten back to me. I guess she has her reasons for doing that. But the best way to get me is by phone. And my phone number is area code 610. And the number is 626-2585. So that's 610-626-2585. That's right outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And so I'm on Eastern time. But you can call anywhere from like 10 o'clock in the morning to 10, 11 o'clock at night. I don't really care. I take calls, especially when it's about business. I do have an email. I delete a lot of worthless emails, so I never know who's trying to get me. If I see it's not about nothing, I delete it without wasting a lot of time. But I will give out the email address. It's G Sabira, that's spelled S like in Sam, U B like in boy, I R A, G Sabira at netzero.net. And always include your phone number if you want me to get back to you, because I probably will not email you back. I read emails. I don't send them out. I'm in Philadelphia. I'm at 505 Baltimore Avenue. I said Philadelphia. I meant right outside of Philadelphia. 505 Baltimore Avenue. I'm in a city called East Lansdowne. That's L-A-N-S, like in Sam, D-O-W-N-E, Pennsylvania. That's 19050. So those are the ways to get me, by physical address, by email, and by telephone.
You also have a website in which you have some information on about a project you're working on to develop some entrepreneurial components with black youth. Would you like to share that?
Right. I have a website. It's www.c like in car, p like in Paul, T like in Tom, cptmentoring.com. I'm with a company called ComproTax. It's the largest African-American-owned income tax preparation company in the United States. And out of my office in East Lansdowne, we run a mentoring program for young people to introduce them to business and financial literacy. So our goal is to create a lot of young people. By young, we mean between the ages of 18 and 30, create a lot of young people who have their own business, either as a supplement to a job they may have, or with the goal of being self-employed. And so we're trying to build that up. Now, a person can participate in some of the things that we're doing regardless of where they live. Our focus is Philadelphia because we want to meet and do things together as a group, but a person can participate on some level even if they live in other parts of the United States, thousands of miles away from Philadelphia. So if you look at cptmentoring.com, you can get a pretty good information. There's some companies that we're adding to the list that you will see on the site. And there's companies that we are withdrawing from that are on the site. So the best way to find out exactly what we're doing at this point in time is to call or email me, and I can fill you in if that's something that you want to participate in yourself.
All right, all right. And some people out there still in the chat room. Serious Honey, give us in the chat room, please post your site to your show. Because you want us to visit your show sometimes, and you know, other people that have shows that have been tuning in, you know, if you have some things that you like to discuss with Mr. Sabir, please make sure you get in touch with him, and you know, he might be able to come on your show also. This has been Home Based Business 101 here with Baba Jahi, and you know, today we had our guest Mr. George Sabir on, talking about his book Money Issues and Black Male Female Relationships. We did extend the show a little bit, went over. I hope people got something out of this dialogue and discussion, and I hope it helps people as they move through their relationships to find ways to always take the higher ground and improve their relationships. We discussed the problems so that we could get to the solutions. You know, I like to always feel good about the fact that me and my wife have been together over 24 years, and, you know, it's you know, I'm the kind of person, I like to talk about a lot of things, and then, you know, my wife, you know, says, well, you know, people don't need to know the different things that we've had to overcome and move through, because really, you know, people don't need to put all of that out there. The main thing is that you're together, you make it through, and people do have challenges. I don't call them ups and downs, but you have challenges in your relationships, and the thing is, if you really got a good relationship, you find a way to work your way through challenges and make sure that you maintain what originally put that sparkle in your eye to begin with. Also, you know, we do we have some very serious business things going on with our company, and I'm going to post our website, and that website that you can go to and you can sign up and get a free home-based business is www.zamzamzuu.com/movements/unlimited. You can go there and sign up and get a free online e-commerce business in which you can buy things from yourself when you go to Walmart, Target, all of this. If some of you have listened to some of the shows, you know how this works, but I want to put it out there because this company is moving and making some major headways and allowing people to earn extra money without any putting out any startup costs. You know, most businesses, there's a startup cost. And we use this vehicle also to help us with our nonprofit, which is Movements Unlimited Performing Arts Company Incorporated. It's a 501c3, 20-year-old nonprofit dedicated to uplifting our young people and also family development. We're a 501c3 Youth and Family Development Corporation. Currently, we're doing gang prevention work here in the city of Rocky Mount, North Carolina. We also have some programs. There's a couple people looking at bringing in the Washington, D.C. area. And then back in our hometown of Baltimore, where we worked for over 20-some years as a nonprofit and also as a hobby. And so, hey, we're out there on the front lines working with young people every day and working to empower them. And, again, we want to thank Mr. Sabir for being on. And, George, you got any closing comments or remarks you'd like to say before we cut this?
No, I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to your audience. And I want people to feel free to contact me if they want to, you know, engage me in some other kind of activity that might benefit both of us. So hopefully they got from the discussion today that I'm kind of an open person. I mean, I tell you what I really think about certain things. So I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to your audience.
Okay. Hey, I thank you. And, hey, as always, brother, I'll be in touch and, you know, see what we can find to work on since we have some common interests in terms of especially our young people today. Take care. And look forward to talking to you again real soon.
All right, same here, brother. Take care.
All right, people, you know what time it is now. It's called My Time. My Time, Your Time, Our Time. Hey, we thank you for tuning in to Home-Based Business 101. We thank you for making this the number one home-based business show here on the Internet. And we close out with our theme song called It's My Time, because you should always make it your time. My Time, Your Time, Our Time. Always a pleasure. God bless you, and thank you for tuning in. And we close out our theme song. Listen to the lyrics of this song, and it will definitely keep you upbeat.
Up the world. We hope you enjoyed the Success Songs original composition. For music and words that create powerful moments in your day, go to success.